That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
This is the John Fugelsang Podcast.
This is SiriusXM Progress. I'm John Fugelsang.
Hi.
Welcome to the Love Fest. That is Tell Me Everything. Bringing good trouble to the right-wing bubble right here at What the Hell O'Clock on SiriusXM Progress Channel 127. Hope you had a terrific Tuesday. I hope you're feeling good. It was a very busy day in the world today, and we would love to put you to bed with everything that happened or wake you up if you're part of our daywalkers. Hello to everybody listening after the last day of April. Hello to everyone listening on demand and on the SiriusXM app and on the John Fugelsang podcast, and of course, much love to all of our evil army of the night listening live. You guys get to be part of the show. That's not to say that you people listening pre-recorded stuff, that's not to say you can't be part of the show either, you know. You people with your lives who listen to this show the next day or later in the week, if you're ever bored or stranded somewhere, you're always welcome to call us in the wee hours. We are at 866-997-GRIT, and we'd love to hear you. We got a good show tonight. There's so much to get to. Professor Corey Brettschneider is going to be here to cover the courts. Reverend Barry Lynn's going to be here to cover the hypocrites. And Keith Price is going to be here to finally bring peace between Kendrick Lamar and Drake, because someone's got to do it. Someone. 866-997-4748. Big announcement. We just did the Stephanie Miller Sexy Liberal Save the World comedy tour last weekend at the Fillmore in Philly. And what a gorgeous, fantastic room. Now we are getting ready to head back to the legendary Barrymore Theater in Madison, Wisconsin. The Barrymore is where we first launched this tour way back in the late 50s, back when Governor Scott Walker was beating up the unions in Wisconsin. I gave Stephanie a whole lot of roofies and said, hey, why don't we go out there and do a show and support them? And the rest, well, the rest is history and documented in various police blotters around the country. So now we're coming back next Saturday, the 11th. That's two Saturdays hence. So two Saturdays from now, Saturday the 11th, the Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour will be back at the Barrymore with Stephanie Miller, Ferrangela, Hal Sparks, and myself. And our special guests will include John Nichols of The Nation, and just confirmed today, we're very thrilled to have this person back, a true hero in our government for LGBTQ equality and a true progressive. Congressman Mark Pocan will be joining us on stage. I'm such a fanboy of his. I'm delighted he's going to join us. Now, if you can't make it to the Barrymore Theater because, I don't know, maybe you live in New Mexico, I have good news. 1 week later, Saturday the 18th, we will be returning to Albuquerque, our first show at Albuquerque in 7 years. I am so thrilled to be coming back. Albuquerque is one of my five favorite cities in the entire country. I love it dearly, and I'm delighted we're going to come there and tell dirty jokes about how shitty these Republicans are. It's a moral kind of thing, and we hope you'll be part of our crusade. Go to sexyliberal.com or go to livenation.com because we're in bed with them. They have to answer for us. Now we're going to embarrass them like we're Columbia University students and they're our parents. You might have heard student protesters at Columbia broke in and took over a campus building overnight, which means a lot of them are going to get expelled, not just from college. They're going to get expelled from the good graces of progressives who agree with the cause. But it's become ridiculous, folks, and we want to know your thoughts on this. The media is covering the students protesting the slaughter and deliberate starvation of Palestinians, more than the media is covering the slaughter and deliberate starvation of Palestinians. We're not even covering the war. We're not even talking about it in our media. We're talking a bit about Blinken trying to bring peace. We're not hearing coverage of the suffering. We're hearing coverage of the students. And I have many thoughts on this. I have been with them all along. But if you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? And I have some very specific financial, personal reasons for not really being on board with taking over a campus building. Also, Donald Trump fined for contempt of court for violating the gag order in his campaign finance fraud hush money trial. It's $9,000. That's not expected to force him into the poorhouse. He will have ignorant white people replenishing that by the time we digest breakfast. Now, Florida's near total abortion ban will take effect tomorrow. And access providers in the Sunshine State are rushing to see as many clients as they can before Ron DeSantis's Christo-fascist cosplay goon squads, very nice, look to shut them down. And if that's not a big enough headache for the Republican Party, have you heard about Donald Trump's interview today with Time Magazine? Donald Trump just opened up a tremendous headache for all the Republicans trying to handle all the bad press they're having over women's reproductive freedoms. All that and so much more. Finally, the winner of last month's $1.3 billion Powerball drawing has come forward. He lives in Oregon. His name is Chang Safan. He's an immigrant from Laos, currently receiving treatment for cancer. And he and his wife are going to share the prize with a friend who split the cost of tickets. I mean, does that mean they split the $1.3 billion two ways between him and his wife and the other guy, or all three ways? Because, I don't know. I think it's this could destroy a friendship. It's 60-40? This could ruin a friendship, you know. If I only got half a billion and you got, you know, 800 million, I'd feel cheated. Seriously. Why can't I have you understand what I'm talking about? Okay, we got a great show tonight. Let's do a show. We have good news for you. The federal government is on the verge of maybe deciding that marijuana is not as dangerous as heroin. I know. I know the government's almost ready to come down on that. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration is about to reclassify cannabis from a Schedule 1 drug to a Schedule 3 drug, which means it is safe for medical use. This was confirmed to the Associated Press by several anonymous sources. Now, I talked about this with Chris earlier today, and Chris was all about, you know, he's been reading up on the Schedule 1s and the Schedule 2s and the Schedule 3s. And I got to be honest, I generally don't. I just ask my dealer when he comes over what's not going to make me feel, and then I go by that. But I had to learn. So Schedule 1 drugs, according to the Controlled Substances Act, which is CSA, which is not Confederate States of America, but somewhere a racist will feel like it's cultural appropriation. Schedule 1 drugs are drugs that are considered to have a high potential for abuse. They're drugs that have no presently accepted medical use for treatment here in the U.S. And third, a lack of accepted safety for use under medical supervision. In other words, this is strong shit that'll kill you. These drugs are classified as the most dangerous and tightly controlled drugs under federal law. Having said that, some of these could save a marriage, and some of these could help people with PTSD. But when we talk about Schedule 1 drugs, that's heroin, and it's DMT, and GHB, and methaqualone. Do they still make methaqualone? I thought only Bill Cosby could get Quaaludes. He's the only person I know who's had Quaaludes in this century. Methaqualone, psilocybin, or magic mushrooms. Okay. Again, we know so much about the use of psilocybin to treat PTSD patients, but it's still classified as a high potential for abuse. I've never met anybody who abused mushrooms or LSD. I no currently accepted medical use and treatment in the U.S. That's not true. And a lack of accepted safety for the I mean, I guess it takes a really long time to change these things, doesn't it? MDMA, ecstasy, is on this list. LSD, peyote, and cannabis. Now, keep in mind, so many states have decriminalized cannabis for medical or recreational use. But all this time, 12 years of dispensaries popping up all over California, legally, taxable, helping economies, but it still remains classified as Schedule 1. Now, this is, we're talking the government's official line still to this day is that weed has a high potential for abuse. Okay, no currently accepted medical use and treatment, and a lack of accepted safety for use under medical supervision. Listen, no one has ever overdosed from weed. And believe me, I have witnessed people try to. I didn't know anything about Schedule 2 drugs, but according to the CSA, these are drugs that have a high potential for abuse. Okay, I'm with you so far. With use leading to severe psychological or physical dependence. Oh, okay. My whole genetic code just stood up when you said that. But unlike Schedule 1 drugs, the Schedule 2 drugs have accepted medical use and treatment. So we're talking opioids, right? Morphine, oxy, hydrocodone, fentanyl, methadone. I hate methadone more than any of those other drugs. Also, amphetamine, like stimulants, are Schedule 2 drugs. So like Vyvanse or meth, depressants like Quaaludes. So methaqualone is a Schedule 1 and a Schedule 2 drug. And then cocaine, opium, short-acting barbiturates, dexedrine. Cocaine's a Schedule 2. Weed is a Schedule 1 drug. And again, Schedule 2 drugs have legitimate medical uses, but they're really tightly regulated because you can easily get addicted and dependent on them. You can only get a Schedule 2 drug if it's prescribed by a licensed medical practitioner, and you can't get refills without a new prescription. Believe me, folks, I tried. I tried to get as many wisdom teeth taken out as I could. How much Percocet can I get? Now, the DEA, as of now, unofficially, is finally moving forward with this plan to recategorize cannabis from a Schedule 1, again, the most dangerous, the most addictive, and no medical value, down to a Schedule 3 drug. It's a bit embarrassing to be having this conversation 25 years into this century, isn't it? This move is not going to legalize weed at the federal level, although Biden has come out for that. But friends, this is the largest change in marijuana policy that our government has taken since the drug was first outlawed back in the 1930s. And almost 90 years ago, when cannabis was criminalized, I want to remind you, the American Medical Association testified before Congress against making cannabis illegal, because back then, in the 1930s, doctors were talking about the health benefits and medicinal applications of cannabis. We've always known. Legal weed is, technically, the conservative point of view. So now, for the first time, we're going to see cannabis change houses. It's going to move from the Schedule 1 house down to the Schedule 3 house. Now, I didn't know this, but Schedule 3 drugs, and again, I give my producer Chris Hauselt credit for me knowing all of this because he was on about this and I realized how ignorant I was. But Schedule 3 drugs, they're the drugs that have a moderate to low potential for physical and psychological dependence when compared to Schedule 1 and 2. I'll certainly agree that cannabis could be habit-forming, but it's as addictions go, it seems to be a lot easier to quit than coffee or cigarettes. Schedule 3s also have a currently accepted medical use and treatment in the U.S., and can lead to low to moderate physical dependence or high psychological dependence. This sounds like the neighborhood cannabis should have been living in for decades. Schedule 3 drugs are other opioids, codeine, hydrocodone, and Tylenol. Tylenol. Products that have not more than 90 milligrams of codeine per dosage. Stimulants like other amphetamines with low abuse, like, again, more kinds of Adderall. And then steroids, testosterone, what have you. Some depressants like barbiturates. And ketamine. Ketamine is Schedule 3. And then products having less than 90 milligrams of pseudoephedrine per dosage unit, like a nasal decongestant that's locked up at CVS. Schedule 3 drugs have much less regulation compared to Schedule 1 and Schedule 2 drugs. They're still considered controlled substances because you can abuse them and be dependent on them, like Tylenol. But Schedule 3s can be prescribed by doctors and refilled up to 5 times within 6 months without a new prescription. A prescription for Schedule 3s might require handwritten prescriptions or electronic prescribing, or in the case of weed, going to that scuzzy dispensary down the block. I mean, Chris, you don't know what New York is like now. Any store, any deli, any storefront that says the word exotic or snacks is a weed shop. Folks, they're selling weed everywhere. in New York. I don't know how to function anymore. Every store you go, you're shopping and you're trying to check out, and they're like, "Sir, would you like some edibles? No, thank you. Oh, but sir, would you like some pre-rolled joints? No, thank you. Well, sir, you want a vape pen?" And I'm like, "Look, I just want to pay for the gun and leave, okay? Please? I came in here to buy 6 dildos and a rifle. Can I just please have my gun?" So, again, Schedule 1 drugs, like heroin, LSD, MDMA, they have no approved medical uses and are at high risk for abuse. And I know people who'd love to abuse all 3 of them. Schedule 3 drugs like ketamine and steroids, moderate to low potential. So again, this is huge. This is the federal government finally acknowledging the medical applications of a flower that has grown here thousands of years before white people ever set foot on this land. And this is helping the Biden administration as they try to decriminalize weed. I will tell you, Joe Biden has come so far on decriminalization of cannabis and abortion. If you had told me 15 years ago he'd be the guy to be the hero in this movement, I would not believe it. This still, of course, needs to be approved by the White House Office of Management and Budget. But this was confirmed to the AP today by 5 people who spoke on the condition of anonymity. It's really happening. The biggest shift in drug laws in more than half a century. And this is after a decade of huge changes in cannabis policies around the country, one state at a time. As of now, at the time the federal government's finally catching up, 24 states have legalized possession for adults, more than half the U.S. population, and 38 states established medical marijuana programs. When I was a kid, you'd hear stories about people who go to jail for cannabis. You can Google them. There's horror stories about people incarcerated for cannabis. I've met them. I mean, John Sinclair just died last month, and he was somebody who John Lennon wrote a song about because he got 10 years in prison for passing 2 joints to someone who was an undercover agent. I mean, it's crazy. You know, when the Last Prisoner Project was first founded, they used the number of 40,000 people in jail for cannabis. That's based on a 2007 Bureau of Justice Statistics report that broke out state and federal incarcerated populations by substance-specific drug offenses. I mean, and that's based on data that was gathered in 2004. We roughly have about 30,000 cannabis prisoners in the United States, people who are locked up for weed, for a flower. You don't have to like marijuana. You don't have to like weed culture. You don't have to like people who get high to really dislike the fact that your fellow Americans are still sitting in jail for possession of this. And these policies today are going to allow cannabis companies to have easier access to banking, investment, and tax credits. That's what it's going to do. It's about the business. It's not about the justice. It's positive. It's bringing us one step closer to exonerating everybody who's ever had a weed conviction on their record, and everyone with a past weed conviction, everyone who's done their time, everyone still serving. But let's be honest, capitalism is probably the reason this happened today. The weed lobby is real. This is for cannabis companies to have easier access to banking and tax credits. But I don't want to get cynical about it. In the big picture, to me, this is another clear sign of how our culture works. This is how our culture has always worked. Every protest movement has taught us the same lesson in this country, from abolition to women getting the vote, to marriage equality, civil rights, voting rights. If the people lead, eventually, the leaders will follow. We want to know what you guys think. We are at 866-997-4748. 866-997-GRIT. And before we go to break, I don't know if you've seen the Time Magazine interview yet, but Donald Trump claimed that undocumented immigrants aren't civilians and would not be protected by the law that forbids the use of military violence against civilians. Trump will not rule out violence if he loses in November. He says it depends on the fairness of the election. And Trump said it's up to the states if they decide to monitor women's pregnancies. And it's up to the states to decide if they should lock up women who get abortions after a ban. Donald Trump is too much of a coward to weigh in and give his own opinion. And that's the story there. Okay, we got a lot to get to tonight. Light up and join us. We are at 866-997-GRIT. We'll be right back. This is Progress.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
This is SiriusXM Progress. I'm John Fugelsang. Thank you for joining us here at SiriusXM 127. Let me quote our good friend Allison Gill of the Daily Beans and Mueller she wrote on the SCOTUS immunity arguments. She said, "To me, we're either here because of incompetence, arrogance, or a corrupt, intentional delay tactic, and none of these options give me a lot of confidence about how the court will rule." I hate to disagree with Allison Gill, but why can't it be all three? Why aren't we discussing the fact that the Supreme Court is literally having this time delay pageant of cosplay where they're debating whether a president has the power to murder whoever he wants because the founders really wanted to still have a king? It's because of incompetence, arrogance, and a corrupt intentional delay tactic. But let me go to someone much more smarter and much learned, more moral than I, Professor Corey Brettschneider, who, of course, enriches lives in the poli-sci department at Brown. You've read the professor's work in Politico, the New York Times, and Time magazine. You can get his book, The Oath in the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents, at your favorite bookstore, with the new book on the way. Corey, welcome back. It's so good to have you, sir.
Thanks, John. And quite a historic moment to be talking about these immunity arguments, the absurdity that I'm going to tonight try to explain to you why it is.
Please.
That's something that we shouldn't even be close to talking about, the idea that the president, after he's president, might be immune for crimes, why that this court is outlining, I think, unfortunately, how they're going to take something that wild and make it sound plausible. And I didn't see it before, but I certainly see it now. And I think it's pretty clear they're headed in a way that really could destroy the January 6th case, possibly the case of Carter, but possibly even the case about the documents. And certainly the Georgia case could be affected too, as Smith pointed out at the oral argument. So something that's, you know, sounds implausible. The president could have immunity to shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it, not just while he's president, but after.
Yeah,
is starting to clear the way. And unfortunately, I see the route that it looks like they're going to take.
It's amazing.
By the way, a damn hypothetical I used in one of the law school classes I was teaching, constitutional law. Now it's come to life and in a way that I wouldn't have hoped for.
I mean, it's insane, Corey. And the worst part about it is I don't think any of them are actually taking these claims of immunity seriously. They're just pretending to, and everyone knows they're pretending to, because this is all about delaying a trial so the American people cannot hear the evidence that Jack Smith has produced before an election, because a lot of billionaires don't want a billionaire tax. So a lot of vacations have been given to certain Supreme Court justices, and the entire thing is, I mean, I can't tell if I should be infuriated or if it's just so bloody silly, Corey, but is it fair to say that none of these right-wing justices, except maybe a lunatic like Alito or Thomas, actually believe that Joe Biden has a right to assassinate Donald Trump and that Joe Biden has a right to lock up any senators who vote to convict him in an impeachment? Because that's what this argument's about, right?
I think that's correct. It's that wild a claim. But I think, unfortunately, I see a way. And let's remember, too, you know, it starts off that they're just considering the arguments, then they start talking themselves into it. They see a route. And And they do have a route based on a case called Fitzgerald that I can explain to making this wild claim seem plausible. I mean, the argument comes down to this, that there was a case about civil immunity, not about criminal immunity, but immunity from lawsuits that Richard Nixon won after he was president. And what happened in this case, which was about a political firing, and the guy sued and Nixon won, saying that he was immune from, that he was absolutely immune, actually, when it comes to civil litigation from these lawsuits. And so the way that it worked is that the court said that you president, when he's president, shouldn't be distracted when it comes to the official acts of the presidency. And if a president is distracted, then that's going to be dangerous for the country, given the power of the presidency, commander-in-chief, and so on. So the court did find for Nixon, saying there was absolute civil immunity for official acts, or as they put it, acts within the outer perimeter of official duty, and nobody's really sure exactly what that means. So now here's the argument that's got a lot of sympathy at the oral argument. If there is immunity for official acts when it comes to civil cases, what about official acts in which somebody's charged with a crime for an official act? Now, you know, one counter argument to this is, how can an official act be a crime simultaneously and an official act? And we have the answer now, which is that if it was a good faith belief that Trump was acting in order to preserve democracy, not destroy it, on January 6th, well, then that might be an official act. And under Fitzgerald, he might have immunity. Now, we could talk more about that. That's a ridiculous argument on one hand, but it is a legal argument. And it's one that these justices, you know, are bending the law to see the benefit. Now, they have to figure out a way of answering your counterarguments, which is, well, what about, you know, shooting somebody on Fifth Avenue? What about, an assassination of a political opponent? Of course, they can't allow for that. But their answer is going to be, well, those can't be official acts, or those are acts beyond the outer perimeter of official duty, to use the language of Fitzgerald. And if they can square that circle and figure out a way to say, well, look, election interference, election protection, that's within the outer perimeter of official duty, but, you know, killing somebody's not, well, then they've figured out a way to protect Trump and not say something that is beyond ludicrous. And that's what lawyers do. It's one of the, you know, fun but now also unfortunate part of teaching this stuff and doing constitutional law, is that you can really make arguments that are absurd sound legitimate. And the court, as it starts to do that, I think it's not just one or two. I mean, I think four, possibly five, are headed in that direction. And
I mean,
that's not
crazy.
Something I would have predicted a week ago.
This is an illegitimate candidate who's running for president because an illegitimate Supreme Court with at least three members who are illegitimate pretty much gave him a free pass on the 14th Amendment. And they're now arguing that presidents are kings and are not subject to laws because the foundation principle that no one in this country is above the law doesn't actually exist. Corey, is the most depressing thing about all of this the way the media is kind of acting like this is just a normal debate for our country? I mean, you know, I'm a bit shocked that the media's hair is not on fire about this.
Yeah, and I understand why, because, you know, people like me come on television or go on radio shows and we explain the argument and the reporters nod and they don't say the common sense thing, which is like, oh my God, what the hell is going on here? Are these justices really going to grant a pass to a president who tried to have a coup? That's really the bottom line.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can just do my, you know, switch back and forth between the common sense me and the me that knows that what you're saying is the height of truth and the me that knows how to make these ridiculous arguments sound plausible. And lawyers get their tone, you know, they have their cases. We have this Fitzgerald case, and you could start to make something absurd sound likely. And you know what? I think this could happen, John. I know this is upsetting to hear to our listeners, and it says something awful about the state of American democracy. But I see these justices going in that direction. They found their angle. They have it's motivated reasoning in the sense that they want to protect them. And now they found their argument that they can get away with. They're not going to say that you could kill somebody, but they are going to say that official duty is immune, and that if you believe that you were protecting the election, the president has the obligation to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. That's what he was doing, trying to protect the election. And he really believed it.
Here's the crazy thing, Corey. You believe that. Yeah. I think this is nothing but a ploy to delay a possible conviction until after the election. And his win was just the fact that they delayed the trial. And I can't tell your point or my point which one's more depressing. I can't tell which one of us is the pessimist and which one of us is the optimist in this equation.
Yeah, I think it's both and, you know. I mean, that's the famous improv line. That's like where what I'll go with it. That it's, you know, the... on the one hand, they're trying to protect him and delay, delay, delay. And they, just to get clear on how the delay is going to work, they're claiming that this discussion that you and I are having is so sophisticated. What is official duty? This is what they're going to say. This is a very plausible route that they're going to take. What is the official duty that would grant him immunity? I don't know. Well, it can't be killing somebody. Is it? Election interference, protection against election interference. What if he didn't believe? Wow, this is so complicated. We, the Supreme Court, are not going to answer it. We'll have the lower court do it. And
yeah, that's it.
The delay. That's all they
And that's all that's going
to
happen, right? They're going to kick it down the curb, but they're going to wait until the end of June to kick it down the curb for a trial that was supposed to start, Professor, almost 2 months ago in the first week of March. This is all just systemic collusion between the Trump campaign and the Supreme Court to get billionaires their tax cut and subvert justice. I mean, it's obstruction. It's embarrassing. And if I may paraphrase poorly, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, they were talking about Ford's pardon of Nixon. Corey, doesn't Ford's pardon of Nixon prove that presidential immunity is not a thing? Ford would not have had to pardon Nixon if presidential immunity existed. And it was hilarious hearing Kavanaugh say how everyone now thinks that was a great decision.
I don't know. I mean, I think on that, you know, I'm giving you this is bad news.
Tell me. Okay, go ahead.
I'll give you the argument on the other side. I think what they'll say is the following, that, look, it was a pardon to preempt what might have been an unconstitutional prosecution to begin with. And it was a way, the president's power to pardon is independent of the courts. Mm. And it was just a way of avoiding what we now have to have. I mean, unfortunately, you know, I do think it's a delay tactic, but I see the route. I see them, you know, having the lower court decide this, whatever route they take, I think they're likely to say no immunity. They could come back then and say, you know, the court got it wrong. The lower court got it wrong. That really, as we study this more, official duty is something beyond, you know, nothing. So here's their hypothetical on their side, something like, well, what if the president, you know, has to make the decision of whether or not to send out FEMA in the middle of a storm? And it turned out that 10 FEMA members died. And under the law, that would be, homicide, you know, a sort of homicide of neglect. Well, that can't be right. The president's immune in that case. That was clearly him acting in good faith and his official duties. They'll use an example like that to then try to extend out to election interference. And they'll say, well, it's just very clear, unclear that Trump had the motive that suggested that he thought he was doing something other than his duty. So I do think it's delay, but that's why I'm pushing this back, because I see from the questions and the angle and the argument from Fitzgerald the route that they could take to finding immunity, just enough. Let me put it this way, too. Not enough immunity to give Biden immunity for killing Trump, but just enough immunity to give Trump immunity for this protection of our democracy that he thought he was engaged in, otherwise known as an attempted self-coup.
Corey, this has convinced me that, you know, we keep talking about January 6th and calling that the coup. The real coup of our government is the Federalist Society taking over the country through the Supreme Court. I mean, and if Donald Trump is reelected, Alito and Thomas and God knows which one of these other old ones can go ahead and retire, and he will just fill it up with young right-wing crypto fascists to replace them. I have to ask you, we're astonished to see that Clarence Thomas won't recuse himself. And of course, even though his wife participated in the terrorist attack of January 6th, not the terrorist attack part, but she participated in the attempt to throw out our government, and her name's all over text to the chief of staff. And we have no power to do anything. There is no accountability of the Supreme Court. Would you, Professor, support an independent counsel to investigate the Supreme Court and produce a report?
An independent counsel to look into Thomas's wrongdoing, you mean?
The entire Supreme Court, all the conflicts of interest, the corruption of the court, the bribery.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'd have to think about that. The idea of an independent counsel really appeals to me in investigations of the executive branch. And then the question is whether or not we need, given the close association of the executive branch and the judiciary, somebody to look at. I mean, here's the first step. It would be to have rules of ethics that bind the Supreme Court. I think we're more likely to get that. And one of the most absurd things about our system right now is that the court makes accountable lower court justices to a pretty serious binding set of ethical rules, and it doesn't have anything like that for itself. And the reason for that, and this is why they'd likely strike down any independent counsel too, is that they think that under the Constitution and Article 3, they are the supreme decider of what the Constitution says. So any law that tried to, and this is, you know, not going to sit well with people, any law that tried to make sure that the court itself was not above the law, that it was subject to some other body, it almost certainly would say is unconstitutional. That's the bind that we're in right now, that they really do. We you know, it's often called the least dangerous branch. That's the phrase that's used for the Supreme Court. Right now, it might be the most dangerous branch. You know, we've talked about other places where this happens. You know, what about the possibility of a court-imposed national ban on abortion? That's not so far-fetched.
Okay, I want to move on to something else, but one last question on this. Do you think the Democrats should be starting to do anything they can do to make Jack Smith's as-yet-unseen evidence available to the public before the election in the event that this court really gets away with this and uses this immunity racket to delay the trial from starting?
You know, one of the things I talk about in the new book in depth and with a lot of original research is that what happened during Nixon, and you'll see how this relates, is that the grand jury was moving forward with the prosecution and they were worried about being blocked. On what grounds? On grounds that Nixon was immune for prosecution while he was president. In fact, Leon Jaworski said that Nixon was immune and would not allow the grand jury in the Nixon case to do this. So a deal was made, and the deal was, let's hand over all the evidence to Congress. So that's how it became public. That's how impeachment happened. And yeah, maybe that a similar thing needs to happen here. It's not Jack Smith who's saying that that Trump is immune, but it might be the Supreme Court. And the recourse is to go to the people, to show us the evidence so that we can act on it. And certainly he's got an obligation to do that if this thing isn't coming to trial. We would have seen it through the trial. We wouldn't see it through the trial. We've got to see it through public documents, through a release that will let us make our decisions for ourselves. If it was enough to prosecute him, it's enough to show it to the American people.
And echoing that, let me recommend Corey Bretschneider's new book, The Presidents and the People, Five Leaders Who Threatened Democracy and the Citizens Who Fought to Defend It, which is available July 2nd, but on sale now. We're going to have quite a party when it comes out. OK, let's move beyond this and talk about Donald Trump, our favorite subject, Professor. He had a busy day today between the gag order fine and the shocking Time magazine interview. What do you make of the gag order? $9,000. It's, you know, he'll have raised that by breakfast, of course, from Rube's writing in checks, but we can say that he's a criminal now, right? He's an adjudicated criminal.
He is contemptible. He is legally in contempt of court. I think that was important. And I think we talked about this last week, that the judge really had no choice as things were headed but to do something. And short of jail, which is possibly the next step, which he's very eager to not do, this was almost required of him. I don't know what the rules are about contempt and the amount of the fine, but it certainly seems very low. But, you know, what it does is it might clear the way for if this continues and if the attacks escalate, he might have to jail him. And now what will that do, you know, to the electorate? We're not sure. But at some point, I don't see what other choice he'll have.
I mean, I certainly don't think he wants to. I don't think any of them want to jail him, but it's been pretty amazing watching this play out. And today was a very, very exciting day in the court. I got to say, for everybody who was saying that this is the trial that doesn't matter, Compared to the other three, that might be the case, but we're on day nine of this. I'm trying, Corey, to not call it the hush money trial. I'm trying to call it the election interference trial as much as I can. It's already fascinating, and Michael Cohen hasn't even shown up yet.
Yes, and, you know, there was a big question. I think we did talk a little bit about this last week. Like, what is the, you know, so he's, it's falsification of business records, but to bump it up to the felony, it's got to be in furtherance of some other crime. And a lot of people were saying, well, what's the other crime? Like some sort of, you know, minor campaign finance violation? No, the crime is this conspiracy to engage in the practice of trying to bury any story about the president and about Trump. And you know, that isn't nothing. It's a wide process of multiple acts of trying to keep information from coming to light and engaged in hiding where the financing was coming from. This is a web of unprecedented proportions. One criticism of this trial is that nobody's ever brought charges like this, and my response to that is, well, there's never been a crime like this involving a candidate for president of the United States.
And really quick, this interview with Trump in Time magazine today, it was a series of two interviews and everyone in his inner circle. There's a lot to unpack here. Deporting 11 million immigrants via detention camps. I don't even think he means that. Letting red states monitor women's pregnancies. The cowardice is astonishing, but he's talking quite a bit about deploying the military within the U.S. against American citizens.
What's scary about that is, you know, if we go back to when their violence was happening in Oregon, or his famous Bible appearance when he called out the National Guard to suppress a protest so that he could have a photo op of the church, all these things that we've somewhat forgotten. What that showed us was that although there's a common understanding that the Posse Comitatus Act prevents the use of the military domestically, there's a way around it, and it's called the Insurrection Act. And Trump knew nothing about politics when he started, and now he knows all about the Insurrection Act. So it's not just that he's got a plan to do the unspeakable in terms of undocumented people, but he has the legislation at his hands that he now understands of how to do it. And, you know, this Supreme Court, if it's considering granting him an immunity for a self-coup, imagine what it's going to do when he uses an actual piece of legislation. This is the legislation, the Insurrection Act, that Eisenhower used in Little Rock, and how twisted it'll be if Trump uses it. He will use it to try to engage in his deportation force.
Oh, Professor Corey Bretschneider, it's always a great pleasure and thrill to have you with us. I just learned so much from you, and you always calm me down, even when you terrify me. What is the best way, sir, for our listeners to follow you and keep up with all your many doings?
The main thing is if you could pre-order The Presidents and the People, Five Leaders Who Threatened Democracy and the Citizens Who Fought to Defend It. It's obviously relevant. It's got this Nixon story that is a direct parallel of what we're seeing now. Go to your local bookstore and pre-order it. That would help jumpstart it and get it going. It's already gotten a start review from Publishers Weekly, so help us out.
Right on. Corey, thank you so much. We got to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with your calls and me thanking you for being patient on hold. This is Progress.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This is SiriusXM Progress. Hope you're having a great one. On his Middle East tour 24, here's Secretary of State Antony Blinken saying a ceasefire deal is on the table. It is good. We just have to see if Hamas is willing to accept a deal based on nothing we've experienced before.
Our views on Rafah, I think, are very well known. The president's been very clear about it. I've been clear about it and repeated it as recently as yesterday. Where our focus is right now, along with the humanitarian effort, our focus right now is on getting a ceasefire. That is the most urgent thing. And it's also, I think, what is achievable because the Israelis have put a strong proposal on the table. They've demonstrated that they're willing to compromise. And now it's on Hamas. And no more delays, no more excuses. The time to act is now.
So Columbia University and the NYPD are now removing students because the demonstrators, who, again, I defend nonviolent demonstrations, and I say all the time, if they break the law, lock them up. If they violate university rules, then you can expel them. But I'm a big believer in the First Amendment, big believer in free speech. I don't like it when student demonstrators might say death to America. But number one, very few are saying that. Number two, that's not illegal. Earlier today, however, as I'm sure you heard, it's been heating up and heating up. And I'm actually disgusted at the story, because we're not talking about the starvation in Palestine. We're talking about these college students and these administrators and these tent camps and these protests at Cal Poly Humboldt. North of San Francisco, student protesters have barricaded themselves for a week in a building that includes the president's office, and they've renamed it Intifada Hall. Someone tell me how a protest like that is more than a petulant, privileged tantrum and actually helps the people of Palestine. Making yourself look like entitled, privileged dicks does not generate the public support that we need to have a ceasefire. So, as you know, dozens of protesters took over the Hamilton building at Columbia University, less than 20 blocks from where I'm talking to you early today. And they barricaded entrances and they flew a Palestinian flag out of the window. And there was footage of people smashing windows. And again, man, I'm on your side. There has to be a ceasefire. I'm not on the side of destruction of private property, because that hurts the Palestinian people who are being victimized. And not to say anything more, but it doesn't actually bring the hostages home any sooner. Doesn't make Israeli people better. All it does is satisfy your desire to cause a scene, your desire to show the world how radical you are. So Columbia announced they had begun to suspend students who remained in the tent encampment past 2 p.m. today. Columbia protester was saying to reporters, "We will not be moved unless by force." And again, you know, when the faculty linked their arms to protest the student protesters, I was for it. Great. It's inspiring. Other schools, including Cornell and NYU, said they're going to suspend or discipline students involved in the encampments. And I think that's really shitty. And I hope they all appeal it. It's a nonviolent protest. Nine protesters at University of Florida were taken into custody earlier today. Cops in riot gear arrested multiple people at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. But today, friends, it jumped the shark. I don't even know how to do this. I don't even want to play this clip, because I'm afraid if you hear this clip, you might turn into a Republican. And I don't want that to happen. You don't deserve that. But I'm gonna play this anyway. This is from earlier today. This is when the students took over Hamilton Hall at Columbia University. And I had to listen to this a couple times, because I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was a big thing. They used furniture to barricade it. That building, by the way, was occupied during a civil rights and anti-Vietnam War protest back in 1968. The student radio station was broadcasting a play-by-play of the entire thing. But once they took over, students had some demands. They were demanding humanitarian relief. They were demanding the school feed them and provide feminine hygiene products. I want you to listen to this clip earlier in the day of a student, a female student outside Hamilton Hall, talking to journalists, and realize this is the moment the entire protest that our media has been living off of for 10 days now. Listen to it collapse right here.
Why should the Jobs
Next Steps.
How would
the
university be obligated to provide food to people who've taken over a building?
First of all, we're saying that they're obligated to provide food to students who pay for a meal plan here.
In the dining hall.
There was a request that food and water be brought in, unless I misunderstood.
To allow it to be brought in. I mean, well, I guess it's ultimately a question of what kind of community and obligation Columbia feels it has to its students. Do you want students to die of dehydration and starvation or get severely ill, even if they disagree with you? If the answer is no, then you should allow basic, I mean, it's crazy to say because we're on an Ivy League campus, but this is like basic humanitarian aid we're asking for. Like, could people please have a glass of water?
But they did put themselves in that, very deliberately, in that situation and in that position. So it seems like you're sort of saying, we want to be revolutionaries, we want to take up this building. Now would you please bring us food and water?
Nobody's asking them to bring anything. We're asking them to not violently stop us from bringing in basic humanitarian aid.
Basic humanitarian aid. Okay. Thank you, Chris. I feel myself becoming Archie Bunker right now, and I'm trying to contain myself. Here's the deal. I'm 100% in support of your Gaza protests, okay? I get it. This was a parody of activism. This was embarrassing. This is a Republican Party wet dream. The students at Columbia who have taken over Hamilton Hall are not at risk of starvation. They are not at risk of dying from dehydration. They broke into the building. They barricaded themselves with wooden chairs and metal tables and trash cans. They do not require humanitarian aid. This is where privilege becomes petulance. And let me make it personal. I went to school in New York City at NYU, and I went to many, 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 many protests that I still do. And now I'm a dad in New York City, and I take my child to protests. When I was a college student, it would never, and again, some of you will really disagree with me on this, and I already sound like Glenn Beck, but when I was a college student, and I went to protests, it never occurred to me to destroy private property at my university or barricade myself or do anything that would risk my enrollment at a private university. You see, I went to NYU on a scholarship, two scholarships, and I worked like crazy. I would work overnight shifts. I went home to Long Island to work in a residential home for developmentally disabled kids almost every weekend to make money. I was a hustler. It would never occur to me to jeopardize my scholarships because I was not a rich kid at school. Imagine the privilege to think that you can take a legitimate protest and then break into a building, barricade yourself in, and demand the administration be responsible to you and bring you humanitarian aid. I would never have done that because my mother and father would have murdered me. Can you imagine a poor kid who hustles and gets scholarships to go to college and then fucks it all up and throws it away? The thought that I would have the cushion to be able to get myself ejected from a major private university and I could just go to school somewhere else, or that I'd be fine if I was thrown out of college because I'm not going to be starving next year. I'm sorry, like I'm saying this as someone who was not raised rich. These are spoiled fucking rich kids. And they're not helping Gaza. They're not helping the children who are starving in Gaza. Gandhi showed us how to do this without violence and shame the oppressors. You think Columbia is responsible to students so they should bring you humanitarian aid? Boo-boo. Columbia is responsible not to students. They are responsible to parents who write the checks. They are responsible to the donors who write the checks. And a lot more parents write checks for kids to attend than kids have occupied this building. Again, you want to protest what your university is doing, that they should divest from their investment in Israel? I get it. It's a great national dialogue. It is a debate that should be amplified, and everyone on every side of the political spectrum should know every possible angle. But destruction? You guys are making it worse for Palestine.
You're making it worse for Israel. You know who you're making it better for? Republicans. Remember Virginia Fox, the really evil shut up lady from a few months back? House Republicans had a press conference condemning these protests. Again, they don't give a fuck about the civilians, 32,000 murdered by Netanyahu, who is a criminal thug. And yes, Hamas are Nazi evil terrorists. They are evil. We're not saying anything otherwise. Both sides, because you put conservative religious people in power, and this is what you get. The evil conservative right-wing Muslims and the evil conservative right-wing Jews. Here's Virginia Fox talking tough like a paper tiger. You students at Columbia who fucked this up made these evil people happy. Listen.
I want to thank the speaker also for making this an all of the House issue. It is an all the House issue. It's an issue for our country. As Republican leaders, we have a clear message for mealy-mouthed, spineless college leaders. Congress will not tolerate your dereliction of duty to your Jewish students. American universities are officially put on notice that we have come to take our universities back. I applaud the speaker for expanding the Committee on Education and Workforce's ongoing investigation into a Congress-wide initiative. No stone must go unturned while buildings are being defaced, campus greens are being captured, or graduations are being ruined.
Okay, that's enough. I can't. You hear her reading a piece of paper someone put in front of her? This evil, amoral, soulless, godless, fake Christian, fascist grandma. This is what they wanted. This is why Mike Johnson came to the country, to wag his finger at Muslims and brown people and college students and brown-skinned female university presidents and New York City itself. They don't care about anti-Semitism. They don't. They don't care about Israel. They don't care about Hamas. They don't care about the starvation. They care about their own power. That's all this was about. If they cared about anti-Semitism, they would have cut Donald Trump loose after all of his anti-Jewish comments he's made, after having Nick Fuentes over his house for Thanksgiving dinner. They don't give a rat's ass about the anti-Semitism. They care about their power. They care about right-wing white people supporting them. And when progressives go too far and allow legitimate protests for moral causes to be hijacked with theatrical, destructive bullshit, the only winners are the evil people. We want to know what you guys think. We're at 866-997-4748. We'll be right back with your calls and the Reverend Barry Lynn. This is Progress.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be. Welcome to Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high-profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he'll chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is SiriusXM Progress. Interesting item today in Axios. House Dems seize control. Marjorie Taylor Greene's fizzling motion to vacate push is dead in the water thanks to Democratic leaders saying today they will block her ouster attempt against House Speaker Mike Johnson. Instead of Republican leadership taking back the power, it's in the hands of House Democrats until after the election. A joint statement from Hakeem Jeffries, Catherine Clark, and Pete Aguilar said the time has come to turn the page on this chapter of pro-Putin Republican obstruction. So Marjorie Taylor Greene said today she's still going to force a vote on the motion to vacate just to humiliate Mike Johnson, even though he'll never lose his job and it will only humiliate her. But it's being shown all around, said all around, that this is a big statement of how powerful the Democrats are. And this came after a closed-door House caucus meeting where a lot of members argued that they have to be the adults in the room and made the choice that they wouldn't have a direct vote to save Johnson. Instead, if Marge does it, they will vote to table it. In other words, kill it. So they'll save Johnson without actually voting to save Johnson. For more, because I need somebody smarter and more moral and more in the know than me on this, and that's most of you, but we happen to have the Reverend Barry Lynn with us, ordained minister in the United Church of Christ, who served as the executive director for Americans United for the Separation of Church and State until his retirement a couple years back. You may have seen Barry on PBS NewsHour, The Today Show, Nightline, 60 Minutes, even The O'Reilly Factor, and you may have read his stuff in the LA Times and USA Today and Wall Street Journal. His memoir is called Paid to Piss People Off. And the Reverend's memoir comes in three different volumes, Peace, Porn, and Prayer. We are always privileged to welcome back one of the greatest guys in the game, Reverend Barry Lynn. Hello, sir.
Hello there. It's nice to be back. Hakeem Jeffries writes me a note and tens of thousands of other people every day. I usually get three. Here's one from today. Dear Barry, that's the donation I'm asking for, $1, asking you to give to the DCCC before midnight. I'm calling for 62 Democrats in your state to give $1 or more if you can to the DCCC to help hold Republicans accountable and reclaim the House for the people. I get two or three of those a day. I really want Hakeem Jeffries to be the speaker, but he will be. Probably. I want him to be the speaker now. I don't like this tactic that he's utilized. A lot of the Democrats that have gone along with this, I respect them. I just think they're wrong about this. And this is why.
Tell me.
Mike Johnson is not just a normal conservative. Mike Johnson is not just a normal Republican. He is the only member of the House who unequivocally says, I am a Christian nationalist. I believe the Bible holds the answers to everything. And if we think that this is just some normal guy who happened to make the right decision by spending $82 billion on foreign assistance, if he hadn't been the speaker, this vote would have happened months ago and the money would have gone a great deal sooner.
Under McCarthy? Under McCarthy, Reverend?
No. If Hakeem Jeffries had been the speaker.
Oh, I see. Yes, of course. Yes.
And if he was a speaker tomorrow, they'd do the same thing. They would have more funding and more good things. This guy, Mike Johnson, I want people to understand, this is not a normal conservative. This is a guy who's opposed to abortion under any circumstance. He hates the LGBTQ community. When you were talking earlier about how much he loves Israel, ask him, are Jews going to heaven? I remember asking Jerry Falwell that on CNN once. He was stone cold silent because he couldn't say it.
Of course. So he's, because if they say Jews are going to heaven, it's going to cost them money. But if they say Jews aren't going to heaven, they're going to hell.
Exactly. So he did cobble together this big, you know, authorization for foreign assistance. And it would help Marjorie Taylor Greene. And she is a nut. We all know that. But is she any crazier than most of the MAGA Republicans that dominate the House of Representatives? I don't think she is. She gets more press because she says things so loudly, but she thinks the same way as the vast majority of those Republicans.
I would say she's better at fundraising for Democrats than a lot of the other congressmen.
Yes, she is. She's certainly even better than Lauren Boebert, who's having a lot of money, trouble raising money, I understand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Bye-bye, Bobo.
So now we know. You know, back in the 60s, when I was protesting every opportunity I could get. One of the things that I really focused on, we thought the United States of America should not be the world's policeman. And then the subset of that is they shouldn't be the world's arms merchant either.
I agree.
Now we're apparently
two different things.
Both. We're both now. Here's the question. I think it's time for every politician, every House, Senate candidate, or presidential candidate to ask one question. Since you're so interested in the national security, including of places like Taiwan, would you be willing to have your son or your daughter be conscripted to go fight there? You know, I hate conscription. Aside from chattel slavery, it is the worst institution ever used in the United States. We didn't need it in the Civil War. We didn't need it in World War One. We probably didn't even need it in World War Two, but we had it. But then we really needed it in Vietnam, when it was such an unpopular war that people would not volunteer to participate in it because they knew that it was corrupt. And it turned out, of course, it was. And even Robert McNamara, the Department of Defense chief in the Johnson administration, came to admit that it was all based on a lie, something called the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. Which purported this. The resolution passed by Congress nearly unanimously said we, the United States Navy, had been fired upon by warships of North Vietnam. That was not true. It never happened. And even Bob McNamara eventually admitted that it hadn't happened. So this
but
is
they
the
wanted
kind
a war,
thing,
Reverend. They wanted
they
a war.
They wanted a war. And now if we want to, but if we really think, do we really think, I do not think that mothers and fathers will send their children willfully to go fight in Taiwan.
No.
I'm not sure they'd go fight in Eastern Europe.
But
they
let me,
sure
let me,
as hell aren't going to go fight there.
No, and I don't think they'll be asked to. But let me ask you about Ukraine, because I think Ukraine and Israel, Gaza, and Taiwan are all very, very very, very different dynamics.
Sure. Now,
I'm anti-war all the time. To me, the Ukraine war only ends when the man who started it gets the hell out of somebody else's country. And to me, I don't like war, but I don't like mass slaughter and rape even more.
No.
And for everyone who thought, oh, the U.S. should have done something when Hitler went to Czechoslovakia, when Hitler went to Poland, all these right-wingers that didn't know what appeasement was, that were throwing that term around at Barack Obama for eight long years, and now they are the truest of appeasers. Mike Johnson won some points with me when he very bravely enraged his entire caucus to go against Vladimir Putin and do the right thing for our allies. Of course, a couple days later, he realized the racists all hated him then, and he had to go to Columbia University to shake his finger at Muslims and female university presidents to get the racists to like him again. But at this point, why is it a terrible idea for Hakeem Jeffries to save Mike Johnson if another speaker battle could lead to someone even worse than Mike Johnson? Or is your contention that there's no one worse than Mike Johnson? And if the Republicans had to do a vote all over again and remove him, I mean, I don't think they'd get the votes to remove him. They can just have a motion to vacate that fails, right?
They could, except, you know, we're now talking about 217 Republicans, 213 Democrats. Three of those Republicans have said, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, Tom Massey, they will support the motion to vacate. So if all the Democrats and those people, they'd only need one more Republican. Would they get it? I'm not sure, but I kind of think they would. But what Hakeem Jeffries and most of the Democrats have said, and I'm not sure they're all going to go along with this, but if they all vote to table this motion, it will in fact make Mike Johnson look every bit more of a master at how to do the work of the people. And he isn't. He made that decision. He brought along, what, barely half of the Republicans on that vote. He will look like a person who can do anything. He can achieve anything. Yeah. I don't want him to achieve anything because there's so little time left. Most of the time Congress will be spending in district work periods when they go out and do nothing but campaign between now and the election.
Right.
So there's nothing going to happen. It doesn't matter if nothing happens. It doesn't matter if they waste another 3 or 4 weeks trying to find a new speaker because there won't be any time for them to do any real damage.
Well, one of the other bills that they signed was the, you know, the catch-all bill that included this TikTok ban. I'm dying to ask you about this, Barry, because I kind of feel like this is a trap Republicans set for Joe Biden to walk into to hurt Joe Biden with young voters. I don't think they're actually going to do a TikTok ban, and I think they're going to kick the can down the road until after the election on this thing. But what do you make of this legislation, and why would we ban TikTok instead of having comprehensive legislation that protects the data of Americans on all social media platforms?
Yeah, that's a very good question, one not really asked. There's almost no evidence at all that TikTok is being used by the Chinese government. Let's say you go back to 9/11 and people were worried about shoe bombs. But if you talked, I used to talk to people in the defense business in Washington, and they could give you, they wouldn't give you all the details, but they'd say, you know, we found 3 people with shoe bombs in the 6 months after we caught the first guy. They'd have data.
Yeah.
When they go to Congress, they don't even say anything. They just speculate. They go, it's possible that they could get some information. Censorship, I have hated censorship as much as I've hated war since I was in high school. And the two things that are always used to justify censorship, first of all, we need to protect the children. and then next, we have to protect America's national security. And in TikTok, you got both of them. So now you have, we're protecting children, because these children, they look at TikTok, they see people with body images that they can't emulate. That's so terrible. When I was in elementary school, I was in love with Anne Margaret. It was unrequited love.
Me too.
But and now, are you going to tell me that looking at TikTok and seeing someone with a positive body image who looks thin and blonde is any worse than going to a Sydney Sweeney movie and seeing this woman with attractive and very large breasts and going, that's the epitome of beauty in America. You don't need TikTok. Mm. We've been doing this forever. The answer is you got to work with young people and say, the things you see in the movies, the things you see on television, the things you see on TikTok, those are not what everyone looks like. And you don't have to look like that accepted.
But you know, Reverend, this is the world that young people are growing up with. This is as real for them as air raid drills because the Russians were going to nuke us were real for me when I was a child. It's I mean, what TikTok and these cultures are, Insta too, it's junior high school forever. This lookism image culture, this fake happiness, putting on a front.
Sure.
It's in other words, it's bringing junior high to last all through adulthood, and it's bringing the worst parts of adulthood to children. But my whole thing is, why should I be more paranoid about China having my data than Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg? Why is the Chinese government going to be shittier with my data than these douchebags?
Yeah, well, the answer is there is no difference. When I saw that Steve Mnuchin, one of the worst people in the entire Trump administration, was trying to get together investors to purchase TikTok, I thought, there's an example of somebody I want to own TikTok far less than the Chinese government. And the Chinese government, by the way, doesn't even own it. It's most of its servers, maybe all of them, are in the United States. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence that they have ever done anything to seize data and use it in a negative way. Do they use algorithms? I assume they do. But I got 5,000 people on my Facebook page, and I only hear from 100 of them. It's because of algorithms. And that's too bad. But you're right. All of these things. Facebook now has a thing very similar to TikTok. Reels. Yeah. And in Reels, you see the same thing. People with attractive body images and by any conventional standard. But we're not talking about doing anything about that because that's American and we don't get to make any judgments about the Chinaman.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You nailed it. And you know, but, you're not going to be elected president running against Facebook and Instagram, but, you know, running against the Chinese, it'll help you with a certain subset. I think this was a trap they set for Biden to walk into because it would be so unpopular with young people to lose TikTok from their phones. And I don't think we're going to see any movement on this, Barry. Do you?
Well, I mean, they got 9 months to figure it out before they kind of pull the trigger on an actual ban, because they have 9 months to figure out how to sell it to some other company.
Well, but they only have 6 months to kick it down the road and have the election be over. I don't think anyone cares what happens after the election.
Yeah, that's probably true. Although, but speaking of censorship, let me plug something here.
Please do. Yes, let's talk about the event coming up, because I'm very excited about this.
Okay. Next Sunday, this coming Sunday, May the 5th, the Kurt Vonnegut Library and Museum is holding a fundraiser in Washington, D.C. Vonnegut Library is a very active player in defending free speech and in providing banned books to schools. In this case, in the Washington, D.C. area, there are lots of efforts to challenge books, whether they're based on race or gender or sexuality, in suburban school districts. And the Vonnegut Library is raising money to give copies of these banned books to these high schools where books are being challenged.
It's amazing.
Dwight Simmons, he's a very up-and-coming African-American comedian. I think he's been named by Rolling Stone one of the up-and-coming comedians. He's going to be there. I'm going to interview Lewis Black, who's the chairman of the Kurt Vonnegut Library Board.
Lewis will be participating with us.
Lewis is going to be there.
Can I just say, Lewis is your biggest fan? Lewis loves you so much. Well, and he is I thought I was your biggest fan. Lewis Black. I mean, and he's an unholy atheist, sir, and he loves you.
You know, every time he introduces me, he says, Barry Lynn is a minister. I never understood that, but he is. So we're gonna talk. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about religion, but we're gonna talk about censorship, about comedy, about the state affairs generally. Probably not gonna discuss Christy Noem's violence against puppies, because I mean everybody's been talking about that.
I know.
But so let me tell you, if people listening to this program want to get a reduced price ticket, if you go to the Kurt Vonnegut Library and Museum and enter a code when you see this event on Sunday, BWL100, that's a secret code. It gets you a significant reduction in the ticket cost for what will probably be a fairly intimate and interesting event.
Nice. I want to go to our phones and bring in some listeners if we could. We're at 866-997-GRIT. Bill in New Jersey is on line 7. Bill, thank you for your patience. We're going to get to everybody's calls tonight. Bill, welcome. You're on with Reverend Barry Lynn. What are you making of these protests we're witnessing now at Columbia?
Well, like Barry, I'm 70 years old, and I remember the protests. I grew up in Jersey when Columbia was happening. But it was a lot more different because people were fighting not to be killed in Vietnam.
Yep.
You know, it was
exactly.
More than just a protest. It was for life.
Exactly.
But what should have happened, and I can't believe that Columbia, with the history they had, should have known how to handle this and had plans and everything. But I think, and they should have invited the students in and had straight discussions and had debates, and could have been a teaching moment that they blew. And would it be even better is if Biden had flown in and participated in it and gave a better explanation for what he's doing in terms of the Middle East. They had to give the weapons to Israel because they had to give weapons to Ukraine. That was the only way they could do that. I think they should just give them defensive weapons and not offensive weapons. No bombs or missiles.
To the point about Biden, though, let me just comment on that, because, you know, Barry, I'm seeing Joe Biden really use this to his advantage with getting all those moderates and independents on his side. Remember defund the police? And everyone was saying, oh, Democrats all want to defund the police. And Joe Biden was like, oh, you gave me a layup. He came out and said, no, I don't want to defund the police. And this is what Democrats do, especially when they're up for re-election, do pro-law enforcement, anti-protester things that show that great mob of undecided white people that you're not too radical. And I think these Columbia student protests gave Joe Biden exactly the kind of argument he wants to have now, that he can, you know, he's not going to risk alienating young people. He can stand in solidarity with lawful protesters and then say, but you weren't peaceful. And I think for him, he's been avoiding talking about the Columbia takeover. But I think that they just gave him a perfect excuse to make himself look presidential and impartial.
I think you're absolutely right. The one thing that the presidents of these universities did that precipitated in part what's happening now on these campuses, they made the foolish decision to go and testify before Congress about internal political matters at their private universities. Mm. Now, the only connection between most colleges and universities and the federal government are monies, grants, student loans. These things do connect. But frankly, it is not the business of the Congress, certainly not of Mike Johnson, who has no connection to Columbia whatsoever.
Correct.
To go in there, bring his letter, which had 69 other people signing on it, some Democrats, mostly Republicans.
Yeah.
But when those three college presidents from Harvard, from the University of Pennsylvania, and from MIT, two of whom are now gone, they mm-hmm. thought they could go and outsmart these right-wingers on the committees. You cannot do that. You cannot do that. Because let's say you're going to the Judiciary Committee, Jim Jordan. Now, I testified before Jim Jordan. This is the kind of thing he would do. He would make a speech, and then he would say something. And Mr. Lynn, I understand your organization sued someone in my district. And then he walk out. So you can't even respond to him. He's not even there anymore. People think, well, wait a minute, we will have a chance to respond. No, no, no. The chair controls the witnesses. If you're a witness and they don't want you to say much, they just cut you off. So and then what did they do? They went to their lawyers, and the lawyers gave them a very lawyerly answers to give. And as someone on CNN said after they were finished speaking, they gave such lawyerly answers that you couldn't even tell they were human beings. You know, I mean, really, you can't win with those odds.
I know.
And it would be best to just say, frankly, I'm not going to go. Are there circumstances under which they might be subpoenaed? Maybe. But you don't just volunteer to go into a lion's den when you know that the lions are bigger than you are, uglier than you are,
yeah,
and in control of the cage environment.
Bill, before I let you go, how do you see this Columbia protest playing out?
Well, I hope it doesn't play out the way it's happening now. I hope that there's a peaceful resolution. I don't think they should be automatically suspending people. I think they should be going out there and speaking with them and giving them what they want to hear, so they'll leave on their own. And it's okay to have debates and everything. And but regarding the Republicans, they're not serious people, as I've heard.
They're not serious people.
They're not there to do any work or anything.
You're correct, sir. Thank you so much for calling, Bill. I really appreciate it. 866-997-4748. Barry, this Donald Trump election interference trial, it's much more entertaining than any of us thought it would be, and much more compelling.
You know, it is. From the very beginning on this show and elsewhere, I was saying this was probably the weakest criminal case that was being brought against him, but it might be moving quickly. I've come to believe, and I was worried about that because I don't think juries pay much attention. Having been on only one jury, and where the other jurors paid no attention to anything that went on and no interest in the instructions from the judge.
Right.
But I was worried that they wouldn't be, but they appear to be kind of on board with this, and the prosecutors are doing a really good job of connecting the dots. They're connecting the fact it is not about an affair with Stormy Daniels. It is about election interference. It is about an effort to violate New York State election laws.
Boom.
Would they be able to connect the dots so that people would say, well, you know, Stormy Daniels, I mean, so, you know, an affair. How is that a criminal matter? And it's a criminal matter because of the way that they have successfully so far tied it directly to decisions to pay Stormy Daniels to be quiet.
Boom.
And then when you look at the cross-examination of the prosecution witnesses, it's not very good. I mean, it's, you know, when it comes up with the process of buying stories and then not running them, and then the defense, Trump defense, says, well, but they did the same thing with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Well, maybe they did. Maybe they did pay for some bad stories, but there's no connection between Arnold and violating California election laws. This is just a red herring. This is just something that the defense wants to use, but it's not very strong. And I think that these jurors are going to go, why is that relevant? And the answer is, it isn't relevant to this case.
So
I think the prosecutors are doing an excellent job, and the defense team, although it's better than some of the nuts he's had before, they're blowing it.
Reverend Barry Lynn, it wouldn't be a complete visit from you, sir, if we didn't talk about what movies I should see, because I have a kid, I'm on tour, I'm writing a book, I have no life, I have no culture anymore. I turn to you, Reverend, a man of the cloth, to tell me what cinema I need to imbibe.
Start with Wicked Little Letters, a British film about a woman in the middle of World War One in Britain who receives vile and filthy notes. Dozens, hundreds of them sent and dropped through her mail slot. Very funny. You should see it.
This is that Olivia Colman movie, right?
It's an Olivia Colman movie,
yeah,
and she is magnificent in it.
I'll see anything she's in.
And then how about Guy Ritchie's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare?
Yeah, Guy Ritchie, I got a love-hate thing with Guy Ritchie.
We all do.
Yeah, I mean, some of them are great.
This is a love one. This is a very interesting story about a relatively unknown piece of British military history. Hadn't really come out until about 2016. Here's Winston Churchill decides the most important thing he can do is to make sure that freighters carrying supplies from the United States can get across the Atlantic without being sunk by German submarines. So he figures out a way that the military brass doesn't like, and doesn't even tell him about it, to make sure that the American transport ships get across the ocean. And
so you like this one? Because this is the one with Henry Cavill, right? It's the one with Henry Cavill.
Henry Cavill. He's in it.
Okay.
And it's awfully good.
Okay.
And then the final is Late Night with the Devil.
Now, this one, I'm dying to see. Yep. You've seen it. Chris has seen it. Callers are yelling at me for not seeing it yet.
It's great. And you can, if you subscribe to Shudder, which is the all horror movie streaming service, it's already streaming for nothing, and you can buy it for a couple of dollars. It's a found footage movie. I generally hate found footage movies because they're done on the cheap. Most of the time they find the footage, it's from somebody's 8mm camera. It's really crappy. Like the Blair Witch Project, which I hated. But this is
I love that film. Love that film. This is an old TV show from the 70s, and it's incredible period recreations of late night, low budget 70s TV.
It is absolutely brilliant. It is funny, it is brilliant, and of course as a talk show host yourself, and I as a former talk show host, I would love to have interviewed the devil. But I, you know, other than Chuck Grassley and a couple other people, I never came that close to the demonic. But it's fun.
I'll have to see it as a talk show host and a Satanist. Reverend Barry Lynn, it's an honor to have you with us. Everyone should go virtually to the Vonnegut event. But what is the best way for our listeners to follow you and keep up with all your work, sir?
Yeah, if you go to barrywlynn.com, you'll see some of the podcasts that our friend Liz Winstead and others did about these books. a little stand-up I did for Lewis Black, the aforementioned Lewis Black, and just a lot of old stuff, old videos of my... I mean, I'm old, you know, I'm 75.
All right, May 5th in D.C. to benefit the Kurt Vonnegut Library and Museum. Thank you so much, Barry. This is Progress.